Hey everybody, it's time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy here in Soho, about to get hit by a truck.
Yes, well, it's a talking truck. It's like some sort of children's comic book or cartoon. Hey, it's so sunny and warm out today. It's kind of like a typical May day.
Yeah, it's shockingly sunny. And so the people are out and about here on a Saturday morning. And so we're heading for a little brekkie.
Now, we did the fundraiser last weekend. So, in fact, you may only be hearing this on MaxKaiser.com. Ed Baxter did say he was going to play last week's high tea with Max and Stacy. But in case he didn't prepare that, I am making this. We're making this episode of The Truth About Markets. It could just be a double header. You know, this might only be available to you on MaxKaiser.com.
Oh, right. Well, there you have it. So it's either way, you're the winner. You're the big winner. You get either one or two. And it's good, isn't it?
Well, last week we had high tea with Max and Stacy down in Borough High Street at the Roxy Bar. And it was really good. Of course, the biggest round of applause came when Ronnie O'Sullivan walked into the room. Did you notice that?
Yeah, of course. Ronnie's the current 5-time world champion. Of course, he's the champion, isn't he?
Anyway, it was a lot of fun. And there were some really good questions. A lot of questions about cryptocurrencies. That was the number one topic for the guests in the audience. And now I wanted to talk about that, Max, because Mt. Gox has been in the news this week. The price of Bitcoin there went down to below $100. Now, of course, because of that, there are many shriekers online saying, Max, why don't you address the fact that Bitcoin is now below $100?
Right. I guess because Bitcoin is not now below $100 or $120. Bitcoin is at $580. Is where you can buy and sell Bitcoin. So it's up 100 times from the where we first recommended it. If you put in 1,000 when we first recommended it, it would now be worth 100,000. It was worth 200,000 a few weeks ago, but it's only worth 100 times where we first recommended it.
Now, actually, the lowest we ever recommended was $2, so it's up 300 times, 3,000% you'd be up.
Fantastic.
So, but, you know, again, I mean, there's no way to stop shriekers. You can explain to them all you want over and over, whether it's, the simple laws of physics or mechanics or science or facts, like the fact that, the shriekers who have said it's under 100, I asked them to go, okay, go buy it, because you could sell it for 600. See if you can buy it for 100.
Yeah. Well, the whole Bitcoin experience is a lot of people are experiencing or discovering money, finance, and markets for the first time in their lives. Yeah. So things that people who have been in the business for many years understand, this is not known, because this is a whole new generation that's just coming up on this stuff for the first time. And so they have no context for it, no history for it. You know, Mt. Gox... Yeah, I could give you 100 examples of something similar happening in the stock market going back 30 or 40 years. It's no big deal.
Yeah. You know, that's the other thing that really divides the shriekers from a few people who seek to learn and understand. Now, for example, there was one debate going on via Twitter where... where do you want to sit? Let's sit up on the corner here.
Okay.
There was one... a debate going on Twitter. Oh, look at their lunch food. That looks good. Two cappuccinos for sure. I'm going to check out this food here. This is a great restaurant. Wow, look at this, honey. This looks so good. Maybe we should take a takeaway. And look at that salmon.
Yeah, looks like good stuff.
Wow. We're heading towards lunch. So we started this quite late today. Normally we're up and recording this by 9 o'clock, but so there was a shrieker versus a human on Twitter, and the shrieker was saying, with the launch of Max Coin, that he was really angry that it wasn't easier for him, And some another, you know, the non-shrieker said, well, it took me a little bit of Googling, but I figured it out. And that was really fun for me. I liked having to understand the process. I had to Google it to find out. Now, that's also how, for example, when we go and make films and record around the world, I edit all those films. How did I learn how to edit on Final Cut Pro? Well, I Googled it. I did it myself. I just took it upon myself to figure out how to do everything, because primarily it was to save money, and to also, secondly, to make sure the vision I wanted always came out. And it was easier to just do it rather than try to explain to an editor. But I learned it myself, and it's a complicated process, but I just did it myself. And because of that, I understand the whole process much more than somebody who's just, you know, hands it over to somebody to do for them.
Yeah, exactly. So, and up and coming soon will be Stacy Coin, right?
Yeah, they're working on it now. The guy, Dave, he was also at that event last weekend for Resonance, the fundraiser. And he had looked at all sorts of options. You know, there are many different options when you create a cryptocurrency to decide upon. You know, not only how many and how long it'll take, or the difficulty, or what sort of mathematical algorithm which you'll use, which sort of signature algorithm. So, but he looked at all of them, and he knows quite a bit about these algos, and he determined that MaxCoin was the best that he could see. And he said there's stuff in there that even he doesn't understand. So he's going to go with that. He's going to go with basically, you know, how, say, Dogecoin is a fork off Litecoin. So basically it's the same thing as Litecoin, but just another fork off it. I think this will be like StaceyCoin will be a fork off of MaxCoin, essentially.
Sure, that's great.
So our cappuccinos are here. I don't want a porridge, actually. I'm just going to have this coffee. So, because I'm going to have some of that lunch there. That looks so amazing. So StaceyCoin will be like lifted off of MaxCoin.
Well, that's appropriate, isn't it? I'm curious to see how they trade against each other. You know, there will be a lot of people who will be buying and selling these two coins based on the Max and Stacy meme, as it were. I mean, Doge is the first meme coin, but I think Max and Stacy will be the first crypto couple.
Yeah, well, currencies often trade in couples. The euro is priced against the dollar. You know, it's a cross rate.
They call it pairs. Yeah. Pairs. So people trade the euro-dollar pair, the pound-euro pair, the ruble-euro pair. So especially since, going back to 1971, there is no gold standard. You know, there is no base currency. Currencies only trade against each other, and the valuation is based on trader sentiment at any given time. So the Max and Stacy pair will be actively traded. I think you could probably buy both and end up doing well.
There's a few sites now popping up. I saw there's one in the UK. I forget the name of it at the moment, but it's like... it allows you, there are five different altcoins. They accept crypto coins, including Bitcoin, Litecoin, Peercoin, Dogecoin, and MaxCoin. And it allows you to basically send in your MaxCoin, and in exchange, you get a gift card for Apple Store, Amazon, Starbucks, or a few other options you have available. So you could use your MaxCoin at the Apple Store, which that's the one I'd probably use, because, like, for example, I need a new set of headphones. And so I'll probably go there, trade in my MaxCoin, and go get some headphones.
Yeah, it's great. You know, it's very got a great cryptography, and it's used around the world. And the current price is a good price if you're looking for an entry point. You know, the Bitcoin is a very volatile situation, obviously. But I think for entry point into a good crypto, MaxCoin is good.
Yeah, well, I like that the more and more crypto sort of guys are looking at it and seeing how good the cryptography is there. Because, of course, we had Nigel Smart, who is one of the top cryptographers in the world, provide us all sorts of input. And you could see that in the coin. Now, speaking of coins, silver has been on an absolute tear this year. It's up 14%. so far in 2014. So it's broken its trend line. It's soaring up. So either this could be a rally in a bear market, or it could be a change in direction.
Well, I think we had 2 years of consolidation in silver and gold, and we had a pullback of an ongoing bull market. So is this the next leg of the bull market in silver? Yeah, I would think so. So I think should have a really good year.
Yeah, so we'll be talking to Jan Scoyles next week about that. Today, we're talking to her on Monday, so okay. The episode will air on Tuesday. She's coming in to the studio at the Kaiser Report Studios in Tower Bridge area of London.
And then, of course, that's all relating to the Get Real show, which is on StartJoin.
Real, I have to up my PayPal limit before I really push it. I haven't been pushing because if anybody gives me more than £1,900, my account gets shut down. I get locked out. I have to give all sorts. I have to go in for meetings, send them all sorts of documents. So I'm trying to do that. That's a long and cumbersome process, but I will do that. Yeah, but we're going to talk to her about Get Real. She's, I think, I'm really excited about that. She's a great television presence, I think, Jan Scoyles.
Yeah, so if people know what you're talking about there. There's the StartJoin is a crowdfunding site. So the series Get Real is going to be crowdfunded on that site. So, you know, I suppose residents should... Well, next time they do a fundraiser, they could use StartJoin. That would be cool, probably. Do something along those lines.
Well, StartJoin.com, this is like a crowdfunding site, in case you don't know. So you could go there. There's a lot of cool projects. I really like the Coxless crew, the four women who are going to sail their boat all the way, well, just a crew boat, you know, a boat, like you would swim row crew. And it's like from Los Angeles all the way to Australia, something like 8,443 miles, and they're going to sail across the ocean, the Pacific. And I saw Pete Najarian tweeted to me saying he had never seen anything like that. He's seen a lot of crazy things, but that seems like one of the craziest things he's ever seen. I know Professor Steve Keen, who knows a mathematical formula of success when he sees one, he's contributed to that, so I will too as well soon. But the Coxless crew, four women sailing across the Pacific all on their own.
Mm. Yeah, it's pretty cool. So they're raising money on the site to do this, and I think they're looking for a total of $200,000 or something. And I think on this StartJoin, it's paying for their water supply or one piece of the on the puzzle, which is kind of cool. And if any of you have projects you want to get funded, I noticed that the guy who made the film Max Kaiser Does Westminster with George Galloway, remember that video that was up a year ago or so?
Yeah.
So he's got a horror film that he's listed on the site. I think he's looking to raise £60,000. And so we know he's a good filmmaker, and we know I think that looks like a winner too. It's all good.
But the four women sailing, so just rowing across the Pacific, just to give you an indication of the journey they're taking. Not only is it 8,443 miles, but they're rowing from Los Angeles to Hawaii first, and that's they plan on taking 50 days for. So 50 days out in the Pacific rowing. And now I don't know what sort of plans they have for security. Like, is somebody going to be sailing near them? What happens if there's a big storm? All that stuff, I don't know. But it's exciting. So what else is in the actual news this week? The financial news, market news, and all that stuff. I noticed that there's an article out yesterday in The Guardian where they're talking about the fact that David Cameron's, you know, policies, welfare policies, all these people have been kicked off the welfare rolls, and basically they go and they argue against it. They say that this is unfair, and they challenge their dismissal order. Now, 58% of the time people do that. The independent panel overturns them being kicked off it. So it turns out they're just kicking people off and hoping that they never challenge it. kind of like this is the policy. I noticed that a financialized sort of policy, because this is what private, say, ticket agencies, you know, when parking enforcement is handed over to private companies, you notice what they do is they just start handing out tickets to every single car on the road, regardless of whether they've violated any parking restrictions or not. And what they're betting on is that enough people won't take the time to actually go to court and challenge this, and that they'll just pay up the £50 or whatever the ticket is. So here they're just kicking off everybody as much as they can from the welfare rolls, and then assuming that enough people won't bother with challenging it. So because so many people are challenging it and succeeding in overturning the decisions, Cameron's government is going to start charging £250, they're looking into this, to anybody who challenges their being kicked off from the benefits roll to which they are eligible.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, this is, unfortunately, there seems to be this binary option of either you have all government or no government. And the subtlety of having a effective government is never discussed. I mean, here in the UK or in the US, there's a role for government, but you have the zealots who are for a corporocratic dictatorship who don't want that. And then you have people who want some kind of state dictatorship. So there's no attempt to forge a representational democracy in any way. In the UK, basically, David Cameron is the voice of special interest, the voice of the private corporation. And he's attempting to create a corporate dictatorship. And he's doing a really good job at it.
Well, I mean, you see this in the Ukraine, which has been, you know, having massive protests, and now Yanukovych has left. And it looks like, you know, Victoria Nuland, who's the Assistant Secretary of State in the United States, and there was a leak of one of her conversations she had with the ambassador to the Ukraine. And what she said is that basically they were outright just plotting the regime change in Ukraine. And this was like 2 or 3 weeks ago, where she said, okay, we're going to get rid of Yanukovych, and who we're going to put in is this guy Yats. And the ambassador to the Ukraine was like, well, what about Klitschko, because he's really popular out there amongst the crowds. And she's like, no, he's not going to be in government. We don't want him there. He can stay outside of government. He's the boxer that Merkel wants. So, of course, it looks like Yanukovych is out today, and the U.S. is installing this guy Yats. So, however, I mean, the reason why they were able to get some of these protesters to go out there and this violence happen, the violence, by the way, if this happened in the U.K., the headlines would have all been about the 10 policemen murdered. Here in the UK, they don't even mention that in any of the headlines at all. They only mention the protesters killed, or they'll lump the police in with the number killed. They don't say that 10 policemen were killed and that's why 100 protesters were killed, which is how they would have led the headline here in London. If 10 police were killed and then 100 protesters, they would have said, you know, 10 policemen were killed and therefore we had to fire back on these people. Anyway, the people that were protesting initially, you know, in the original protest, when all sorts of normal, moderate people were out there and whatever, is that because Yanukovych didn't sign this EU trade deal. And the EU trade deal was that basically if they signed this EU trade deal, they weren't allowed to do any business with Russia at all. So he was like, well, half of our population here is Russian. And, you know, we get all of our natural gas from Russia. So how can we not do business with Russia? But this is what the EU wanted. They're not allowed to do any business with Russia. So these people are out there protesting that he didn't sign this deal. And then I look at the UK and I look at Europe, and these secret trade deals are currently being negotiated as you listen to this. They are being negotiated. It's called TTIP. And you are losing sovereignty. Whether, you know, if you're here or in France or Germany or Italy or Spain or Portugal, right, a lot of people have a problem that they have to, you know, that Brussels has so much power over their own sovereign governments. Well, now there's a new layer, and that's TTIP, which is the corporations have ultimate power over Brussels, which then delegates and controls the nations. So it's like a new layer of power over which there's supreme sovereignty over your own country. And yet nobody seems to be... They certainly wouldn't go out and protest, especially if Boris Johnson's water cannons like start hosing them down.
Mm. Right. So in the UK, in the Ukraine, they, you know, the thing about this conflict is that it's, you know, people don't like the fact that Russia has an independent banking system. So it's not part of the Fed and the IMF and the World Bank. So that's why there's this all this nonsense going on. I mean, it's not about Ukraine. It's about Russia's independent central bank. So this is a proxy war, a proxy financial war. This is World War III. This is the currency war. And Russia's attempting to defend its sovereignty of its central bank against IMF, World Bank, Fed, ECB. And... it would be nice to have more than one central bank in the world. I think having just one central bank in the world is going to lead to more of what we see, huge wealth and income gaps, and the neo-feudal trend will just continue. So, I mean, competition is good. It would be good to have at least two major banking centers in the world instead of just one monopolist. But clearly, with the U.S. can openly... stage a coup d'etat without any real pushback is an indication that we're heading toward a monopolar world run by you know, people whose interest is in printing trillions of dollars for themselves, and everyone else is, you know, being marginalized. And so the poverty rates in this country, you see the propaganda. So the people who are being squeezed out, whether it's that Channel 4 show they did on Benefit Street, remember that? You know, they showed people who were being targeted by the government, who were the victims of the government, who are been marginalized as being savages, as being the others, as being dirty, as being, you know, they don't have the right DNA. You know, it's very eugenics, very eugenicist in their approach. And these people, unfortunately, are being targeted. So, meanwhile, the folks that are committing massive fraud by printing all this money are celebrated as leaders and have business acumen, etc. So that seems to be continuing. I mean, I don't understand why. I thought when I heard about that show, Benefit Street, I assumed it was about the city of London. I was surprised to find out it was about the people that are being tortured by the government in Birmingham and in other locations. But I guess that's propaganda for you.
Well, you know, we did a recent interview with Simon Rose of SaveOurSavers.co.uk. If you go to MaxKaiser.com and look up that recent Kaiser Report episode, you'll see, speaking of benefits, the benefits that certain bodies have received based on the wealth redistribution caused by 0% interest rates, not even just quantitative easing. This is just the rates being set at 0.5%. And that is, in the U.S., the numbers were something like $600 billion taken from savers and pensioners like your mother and shifted to the government, number one. Number two beneficiary was corporations, because, of course, they could issue bonds and capture that spread, and it went to them. You know, the zero, they could borrow at 0.5% and issue bonds to, you know, normal consumers at like 2 or 3%. And then banks in the U.S. were big beneficiaries, to the tune of something like $200 billion they received because of 0% interest rates. So, of course, most of that went to their Christmas bonus, which is a sort of benefits from provided by the savers and taxpayers of the United States. So that's $200 billion they received from this 0% interest rate policy. in the UK and Europe, it's been just as much taken from the population, but more of it went to the government than to banks. In fact, it was a negative impact on banks in continental Europe. And there was also a big benefit to corporations who benefited from 0% because they could borrow cheaply.
Yeah, so you mentioned the cops in the Ukraine that were killed. They were killed by bankers. You know, the same people who killed Aaron Swartz. The same people who are pursuing Kim.com. You know, these are killers. And there's no law against murder if you have the right connections.
You know, speaking of the protesters killed in the Ukraine, you know, I saw a lot of shrieking about that from people, many Americans, who will be like, these cops shot dead people who were throwing rocks. And yet, if you look at any article about from Palestine, for example, when the IDF shoots dead Palestinian kids who are throwing rocks, they talk about the savage rock throwers and they should be killed and it was one less jihadi in the world and stuff like that. And last week as well, there was a Mexican national shot dead at the U.S. border. He was on the Mexican side and he threw a rock at, allegedly, at one of the border guards and he shot him dead. And now if you look at the comments on the articles, again, you see all these people saying, Darwinism, because the guy was throwing a rock at a guy carrying a gun. He deserved to be killed because he's too stupid to live. Yet those very same people will shriek about the Ukraine because this is how propaganda works.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Israel there. The first thought that came to my head was Tony Blair in the news this past week. And what's the story there?
Well, it emerged in Rebecca Brooks' testimony in the high court this week that an email that she sent regarding her one-hour conversation with him where he was advising her, Rupert Murdoch, and James Murdoch about how to deal with this phone hacking scandal. And basically, he said that, phone hacking crime. And he said, just set up a so-called independent inquiry like the Hutton Report, the Hutton Inquiry, in order to absolve yourself. So he basically outed the Hutton inquiry as a sham, as everybody knew, and yet the population accepted it. So, you know, we weren't out on the street like those people in the Ukraine. They accepted it because...
Like we said on this show a couple of weeks ago that in the UK, when there's a war crime, what happens is they start an inquiry, and then they bury it. And so then less than 2 weeks later, Tony Blair said... And now it's part of the testimony for the phone hacking scandal that he was caught committing a war crime. So he started an inquiry and they buried it. You know, I mean, it's again, there are victims, you know, the dodgy dossier and the fact that the weapons of mass destruction was a fabrication to justify an invasion so that Tony Blair can now be prancing around the Mideast cutting huge deals for oil. Remember, it was blood for oil. But again, I mean, my heart goes out to the soldiers, the UK soldiers who were sent there and lost their lives. So for Tony Blair's Christmas bonus, I mean, that's what it should say on their epitaph. Here lies soldier Joe, you know, Tommy Brit person who died for Tony Blair's Christmas bonus. It's sad, but I guess the families never object, so why not?
Well, more than up to a million Iraqis lost their lives as well, and many were tortured, and many were sent off into torture chambers in Syria or Guantanamo. So there were a lot of innocent people who didn't even ask; they didn't sign up for any, military and the training available and the pension and benefits with that. They were just innocent people walking around their own countryside.
Well, not only did he stick a knife in the back of UK soldiers, but he committed genocide in Iraq. I mean, that's the war crime. And his solution was start a fake inquiry called the Hutton Report and bury it. And so his advice to Rebecca Brooks after the during the phone hacking scandal is start a fake inquiry and bury it. And so, you know, that we know now that, you know, if anyone doubted Tony Blair should be at The Hague for... International Criminal Court for war crimes, I think we're disabused of that now.
Well, think of this notion. Okay, here's Tony Blair said, set up a fake inquiry in order to whitewash your crimes. Now, as I said, here the docile population is very docile in the face of TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. So what TTIP sets up is it enshrines this into law that you cannot challenge. It's called an arbitration panel. And this arbitration panel of three lawyers appointed by the very corporations that have written this law, TTIP, this trade pact, what this will mean is that they get to set up essentially a Hutton-like inquiry that has power of law over your own nation. So yeah. your government can never challenge their decisions about whether or not, say, JP Morgan committed a crime. Okay, we're going to put this on pause for a moment. You see, that wasn't so bad. We're back. And it only seemed like a fraction of a second, but we're in a different club, a quieter club. And I see they have their air conditioning on because it's slightly warm outside.
Yeah, it is after. Yeah, I don't know why. Anyway, what's this Independent says? My changes are bigger than Clause 4, says Miliband. What's the Clause 4? Anybody have any idea?
That goes back to Tony Blair, doesn't it? There was something about Clause 4 that politics is a game now watched by fewer and fewer spectators. Ed Miliband has warned while pledging to commit labor to the biggest devolution of power in the party's history. I think Clause 4 had to do with Tony Blair abolished it, which was Clause 4 was a symbol of what we believed, but this is bigger than Clause 4. It was about, I think that had to do with unions and stuff like that. So everything goes back to Tony Blair these days in the Labor Party.
Under this plan, anyone will be able to register as a Labor supporter, yeah, for £2 a year or £3 a year. Show Labor recruit thousands of new members, opening up the party to ordinary people who don't want to go as far as joining a political party. This is about addressing the disconnect people feel about politics and opening ourselves up, he said. Okay, so this is the front page of the Independent. I've just read three paragraphs and the headline, and I still have absolutely no idea what this is supposed to mean. I mean, this is typical British politics. It gets back to what we were just saying, is hold an inquiry and bury it. Okay, now here's Ed Miliband, who leads the Labour Party, the opposition party. He's saying something that's on the front page of the paper, but it has no meaning whatsoever. Do you get it yet? I mean, what?
Huh? Well, I do know. Oh, hi. Thanks for bringing the coffee. Can you also turn off the air conditioning?
Yes.
Because it's a bit cold in here. Well, Clause 4 was the very first thing that Tony Blair got rid of when he became leader of the Labour Party, and it was the birth of New Labour, and it had something to do with the unions and all that stuff. So they basically, by getting rid of it, they became a neoliberal party of the same, basically Thatcherite light, but so they're speaking code to the people who will be old labor.
Well, here's a quote. We would have been a better government if we had been listening to people on the ground. Well, I mean, this is absurd, isn't it? I mean, the point of government is to listen to the people, not to be a better government. So this should be instantaneous cause for dismissal. I mean, he's admitting that he hasn't been doing his job at all.
Well, they've been kicking people who are on the ground. To tell you the truth. But, you know, I also wanted to, it sounds like what he's saying. So it's £3. You pay just £3 to form party policy. It's a radical plan to connect with the people. But this is like the new modern app age. You know, you download this app and you connect with people around the world, or you play a game with people around the world. And all the apps, of course, are an NSA way to view you in some new form. But I wanted to talk about this WhatsApp thing, which I had never heard of until Facebook bought them for $19 billion.
Yeah. Well, it's an app that lets you to communicate. It's free. They don't charge any money for the first year, and then 99 cents for the second year. They bought it for $19 billion, and the company last year had revenues of $20 million. So also per employee, that's almost almost $500 million per employee. There's only 50 employees at the company. And the barrier to entry to that business is zero. Mm-hmm. Anyone can get into that business. And there's already another one that you pointed out this morning, which looks like a superior technology that's safer. So, of course, most of the acquisition is using Facebook stock. And, of course, Facebook stock is worth $130 or $140 billion because, you know, of click fraud. Remember the click fraud story that came out a week ago or 2 weeks ago? Most of the revenues of the company are generated by hiring surrogates in third world countries to commit click fraud, which they then monetize as quote-unquote advertising. So using the stock price, which reflects click fraud, they spent $19 billion to buy an app that makes virtually no money. And, of course, Facebook on this news, I think, went up in value. So this is a huge bubble in these equity prices. When it pops is hard to guess, but I think with gold and silver on the way up, it's showing that money is starting to move back into hard assets like gold and silver. So I guess the clock is ticking now on the stock market bubble.
Well, you know, the way you describe the situation for WhatsApp and the competitor, which is allegedly better, is Threema, Threema.com, which has a end-to-end encryption, so there is no NSA in between you unless they find a way. But it reminds me of just this is our financialized world, isn't it? Where there's a lot of money spent, but no revenue on the other side. So the other information that came out this week was the latest Fed data about debt in the United States. And the thing that has surged is delinquency on student debt. And student debt has surged during this financial crisis. And there was an article by Frances Coppola where she was talking about, you know, you're paying more and more for less and less value. Your education has less and less value because everybody's doing it. Everybody's going into huge amounts of debt for an ever increasing cost of education. And you look at the chart for the cost of education and it's straight up. Whereas you look at the average income for graduates and it's slowly going down. So getting wider and wider apart. So you're paying more for something that has less and less value, less and less revenue on the other side.
Yeah, well, education is part of the public domain, the public good. It educates people, and these people, when educated, then enter society having had an education. So when you privatize education, you end up with what you're describing. Costs skyrocket, quality collapses, and people are not educated. So they leave these institutions in debt and uneducated. They, for example, 20 or 25% of Americans, according to a recent poll, believe that the sun orbits the earth. So clearly the education institutions in America are failing. If the basic knowledge of a 9 or 10 year old is not being communicated by the time they get out of school, being 22 or 23 years old, but they've got $60,000, $70,000 in debt, and they don't even know which orbits which, the sun or the planet Earth. So that's, again, getting back to this conversation of it's either all or nothing in terms of government or no government. There is a place for the public domain. There is a place for public service. There is a place for education. There is a place for health care. There is a place for transportation. These things are best managed by the public, for the public, by the public, in the public domain. To privatize and financialize these things, it doesn't work. It's not a good use of privatization and financialization. Privatization and financialization is, you know, and is good when you have, let's say, five or six soda companies battling it out for market share around the world. That's a good use of the private sector in creating everyone's favorite beverage at low cost. But no, when you apply it to healthcare, education, or transportation, it's insidious. It actually works backwards. It creates a nightmare. Like the education here in the UK is becoming crap, and it's already completely busted in the US. Another public sector, another public good in the public domain would be journalism. And you see the U.S. is not even in the top 40 now for press freedom or free speech freedom. 40 other countries ahead of it now because, again, another public domain has been screwed by the likes of people like Murdoch and his phone hacking scandal and Rebecca Brooks and Tony Blair and, you know, this idea, the idea that it's just, it's sadism, basically. I mean, it's not just saying we like free markets, because it's not a free market. When you have, it's like, I mean, this is the leader of North Korea, I'm sure he believes he's engaging in free market activities when he puts thousands, hundreds of thousands of people into gulags. He says, well, that's what the free market told me. I read Ayn Rand. I'm a Milton Friedman disciple. That's why I put all these people into the gulag. I believe in free markets. In his mind, that's what he believes.
Well, you bring up education and the media and journalism, which makes me think of Thomas Jefferson, who was the very first to try to bring public education to America, because he thought it was very important for the population to be educated. Otherwise, we could not keep a republic, because if the population were stupid. But he thought also that the journalists and the media should be providing real knowledge rather than what, especially via Fox News, since Fox News and then cable news after it, mimicking it, has brought to America is superstition and myth and conspiracy and the uneducation of America. This is why it's no coincidence that these sort of backward thinking and confusion in the population mirrors the rise of Fox News as well. So, I think that has a lot to do with why over half of Americans, now more Americans believe that in creationism than believe in evolution, for example. So I think that's probably not coincident.
Because they don't have a functioning education system. So when you remove education, you go back to superstition. Superstition was prehistory's version of education. You know, people needed ways to remember when to plant stuff so that they wouldn't starve. Mm. So they create stories and myths about, well, you know, the goblins and the ghosts come out of the forest and they eat all the children. That's a myth and a warning to remember to plant stuff so that when spring comes, you have food to eat. Superstitions and myth and legends, and this is what prehistory man tried to deal with to survive. Then came something called the Greeks, who decided that, you know what, or the Babylonians, the people living there in Cairo in Egypt, the Egyptians, the written word, the symbol, the idea that you didn't have to believe, you didn't have to worship a rock or a twig. You know, the end of paganism, the beginning of post-paganism, and this led up to the Enlightenment. And then free market as expressed through the principles of the Enlightenment. And then that peaked, I guess, around in the 1960s, when it looked like, you know, people were actually going to enjoy a peaceful existence and cohabitation. But then the forces of darkness said, no, let's kill all the hippies and let's bring in Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher to, you know, do their thing. And let's turn education into a cesspool of stupidity. And here we are, 35 years later, dealing with the consequences of having destroyed the public domain and giving all of our trust to psychopaths and kleptocrats and sadists who now run all the major institutions and political power. And nobody personifies this trend more than Tony Blair, who is probably the Antichrist.
Mm. Well, Tony Blair, Rupert Murdoch, you know, the thing that unites them is Leo Strauss, who Leo Strauss was Chicago School, and he believed that, along with like the likes of Milton Friedman, that superstition was good to instill in the population because it kept them quiet, it kept them obedient, and it made them very easy to control, and that only a few, the elite, should be know things and understand things, and that to lie to the public was necessary in order to keep them quiet and obedient, and so that good things could happen for the elite. So I think you see that Leo Straussian in operation, and people, people seem quite happy with it. Ignorance seems to be bliss. Now, in Arizona, yesterday, they passed this anti-gay legislation. Now, it has to be signed into law by Jan Brewer, the governor of Arizona. We don't know if she'll do that or not, but it's passed the House in Arizona, and this is that any company can choose to not serve gay people if it's against their religion to deal with homosexuals. So, of course, there's no shrieking about this on Twitter.
Where's Stephen Fry on this? I thought he was campaigning for the gay community.
Well, this is the sort of moment where a lot of his income comes from America. It comes from the United States. It comes from Broadway. It comes from Hollywood. So it'll be interesting to see if he would put his income on the line to condemn America and Obama's America.
Here's my guess. No. You know, you mentioned Leo Strauss. Before Leo Strauss, of course, there was Freud and Carl Jung, who explored the unconscious and subconscious mind. And then the split there was Carl Jung was talking about the man and his symbols, the mandala, the collective unconscious, and the connection between modern man and mythical prehistory man, and to understand the current state of one's existence is to delve deep into the history of these, what he called the hero with a thousand faces. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all part of the same story. Versus Freud, who was believing in the essentially the battle of the sexes, if you will. I mean, as the driver of human history and the base carnal instincts as being the sole and primary force driving actions of humans. And so here we have, obviously, the path of Freud in things like modern finance markets and economics, where, or what you're talking about, the abandonment of education, the abandonment of the Enlightenment, the abandonment of the public domain, because you have people in power who are, you know, have a Freudian censor in their psyche, which is driven entirely by their basic carnal instincts. So we constantly have these scandals of politicians and their petty sexual crimes and aspirations, which end up resulting in our political destiny. You know, Thomas Jefferson or some of these other leaders around the world tap into that Carl Jungian collective unconscious, where things and actions are driven more as a, let's say, the gestalt of having a connection to the universe as a whole, which unfortunately you don't have anyone talking in those terms anymore. It's only about, I want it now, give me it now, I'm sexually aroused. I like the Super Bowl. Here's a good example. The Super Bowl in America, which is men armed, you know, men in armed clothes, armed armor, battling, running into each other at high speeds, causing massive concussions, chasing a ball around for multi-million, tens of million, hundred millions of dollars worth of bonuses, interrupted by a halftime show of women wearing no clothes, engaging in exotic, primitive acts of sexual behavior. After the Super Bowl, we know now from the metadata analysis of the online traffic, the surge to porno sites by men surged by 60,000%. So the result of this 3 or 4 month buildup, the commercialization, the advertising, the sexuality, sexualization, the violence, is to provide wanking material for 20, 30 million American men and men around the world to wank. That's it. That's the sum total of this $200 million extravaganza. Does that push forward humanity as a whole, as a species? Are we going anywhere? No. So now you understand that if the country's willing to spend $200 million on a wank fest, then you understand why education's been abandoned, free markets have been abandoned, the public domain has been abandoned. We are now coded in a blanket of the effluent of horny men who have been frustrated by not being able to have intercourse with cheerleaders. That's it.
But this abandonment of curiosity, the fact that the population itself, you know, revels in sort of ignorance and this sort of, you know, thickness. I remember Jeremy Clarkson writing his hysterical piece about 6 or 7 years ago where he had traveled across the U.S. to make some program, a series of programs, and that he had never seen so many stupid people, like never in his life, that just this thick, you know, lack of curiosity, this dumbness of people all across it at various, you know, gas stations and petrol stations and fast food joints and stuff like that across America. So when I look at places like with a more equal sort of society, fewer dumb people intentionally created, like say Europe versus America, you know, I look at those images of that you often see where Medicine Sans Frontières, for example, will go out to West Virginia and thousands and thousands of people crawl out of the hills with no teeth or their appendix hanging out of their body, you know, weird stuff going on. And they have no health care,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they don't seem to fight for anything. Like, they don't seem to have any sort of sense that, you know, things can be better. It's just they don't seem to strive for, like, how are they in a situation where they're, you know, large intestine is hanging out of the side of their body and they're just, they don't do anything about it because they can't go to the hospital or they won't be treated. Or it just seems like this sort of, it seems part and parcel of this lack of curiosity by the people, like this lack of, they choose ignorance because it's easier in a way.
Well, they have no peace of mind. Because they're obsessed with these health issues that could easily be avoided. They're obsessed with their ignorance that keeps them constantly in a state of fear and confusion because they think that a monster from outer space is about to gobble them up because they read about it on a tabloid paper at the newsstand where they're buying a Twinkie to feed a family of 17. And so there's no peace of mind. There's no ability to contemplate, be contemplative, to soak in the spiritual quality in any way, shape, or form. That's why you have so many serial killers in America. I think I just saw a statistic that at any given moment there are 30 active serial killers in America. So at every single moment there are 30 guys wandering around committing multiple murders. I mean, these are people that have been abandoned by society, grew up in an institution, sexually assaulted as an infant, given a free gun, you know, for opening a bank account, living on a diet of methamphetamine and Dunkin' Donuts and coffee and cigarettes. And the brain turns into a diseased killing machine that they only find a connection to reality by murdering people. And that's, unfortunately, some of those people end up in office. And I think some of those people end up running banks here in the UK and in the US.
You know, the other abandonment of curiosity and progress and advancement is like the scourge, if you want to call it, of heroin. That I this is amazing, this story about people just dulling themselves with heroin because they can't afford healthcare. They can't go to the doctor. These are the people that can't afford to go and get, you know, various sedatives and oxy. So they buy heroin because it's only $10 a packet, and they just dose themselves. And
another legacy of Tony Blair.
Yeah.
And the Afghanistan invasion, Iraq, the bumper crop of heroin coming out of these locations has never been higher. Mm. Prices have never been cheaper. And again, this is a byproduct of war criminal, genocidal maniac, crackhead, and all around knucklehead.
Tony Swiss?
Remember that show, The Fast Show? They had a character named Tony Swiss who was Swiss a used Tony. Swiss Tony, the used car salesman.
Yeah. So, well, we only have a few minutes left in this program, so how do we want to wrap this up? That you know, Tony Blair is back. I saw Nicolas Sarkozy who is a very similar to, I think, Tony Blair for France. He's meeting with Angela Merkel this week, and people are thinking that this is the return of Sarkozy, that the next elections. So, I mean, presumably he'll win again, and he'll just be as unpopular as François Hollande, and the French people always hate their leaders. But what do you think is going to happen with Sarkozy?
Well, having lived in France for many years, starting in 1990, I was always amazed at how the quality of life in France was extraordinary, and because they haven't paid their bills for 20 years. You know, 30 years. They just decided there, and they just gave a Gaelic shrug and said, "We just not going to pay those bills." And then now they're being forced, like Greece or Cyprus, they have to pay the tab. And so, you know, that quality of life that was artificially being supported for decades is now going to have to come crashing down. So that's too bad, because it was really quite a charming place, even in 1990. It was still extraordinarily charming in Paris and in France. But it's coming from the U.S. You have to scratch your head and wonder, how is this frickin' possible? How is it possible? And, of course, it's impossible. And now they have to, pay their debts.
Well, even more beautiful and amazing is Italy. And now those numbers that came out last year, whereby the Italians are actually the wealthiest of all Europeans. They have most wealth to their name, far more than the Germans, who are one of the poorest citizens of Europe. They have the highest earnings, and their nation is wealthy, and they don't have much debt. But unlike Italy, which has a huge amount of debt. Now, I saw that in these final moments here that they there's some sort of capital controls being installed there. They're suddenly looking at, basically, they're adopting a U.S. style of chasing their citizens around the world of how much money they have, and they're trying to take it. And the capital controls have hit the Bitcoin companies that are there, because they're looking for people's wealth and assets around the world.
Yeah, well, if you read Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper back in 2008, 2009, you know, the reason Bitcoin was created really was in response to creeping capital controls and oligopolization of the banking industry. So, you know, and so what he predicted, you could say, even if Bitcoin never came around, he predicted what we're seeing now, is that the level of capital controls is reaching absurd overreach levels. But he did create Bitcoin, and it is fundamentally changing the discussion around the world, and changing the fortunes of various countries around the world, and so that's it's hugely disruptive, as the saying goes. I mean, you could say it's disruptive, you could say it's revolutionary, you could say it's the second coming. It's a big event. I don't think people understand how significant the event is, but we will, in another 5 or 10 years, look back and understand, I think, how incredibly important the Bitcoin revolution has been.
Well, with that, I think that's a perfect time to end this episode of The Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM at in London, the best radio station in the world.
Bye, y'all.